I'll just give another example, which, you know, comes up particularly, you know, from Gaudiya Math circles about this concept that, you know, had Prabhupada been here now, he would be teaching a lot more things than he did 30 years ago, because devotees are more ready to hear other things. Namely, he would be, you know, speaking about Radha Krishna Leela and spontaneous devotional service and so on. And I would say that that's also, you know, crossing the line. In other words, that Prabhupada's vision and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's vision of a worldwide preaching organization is based on the public presentation of Vaidhi Bhakti, and that's not going to change. And if you cross that line, you're becoming over-intelligent. You don't understand Srila Prabhupada, neither you really understand his mission. It may be that 30 years later, you could personally approach Srila Prabhupada and talk to him about these type of discussions, and he may encourage private and personal cultivation when, and then the other, if you approach them in the right mood, as you mentioned, if you have the adhikar, the qualification, then Prabhupada may encourage individuals to do something that he didn't necessarily encourage 30 years ago.
Right.
So, in one sense, that's sort of the balance of, you know, thinking that, well, we've matured. What does really maturity mean in this context of, you know, how one is approaching the absolute truth and how one's cultivating one's devotional service, what's one's anushilanam is, what one's cultivation is, and what are those sacrosanct things, those sacred cows that you can't touch? What is the thrust of our mission, balanced off with what is actually the right of the individual as he actually does mature? But in Prabhupada's absence, physical absence, then you've really got to be a lot more careful than in his physical presence, because then it really becomes a matter of Krishna consciousness and qualification, that you have to feel that there is actually some vindication, or more than vindication, but there's actually some impetus and guidance from Srila Prabhupada from within and from the body of senior devotees for making those type of steps. Anyway, that's sort of one from a different topic. So even if we,
I don't think it's a different topic. I think it's an elaboration.
I'm a different example.
It's an elaboration.
Yeah, same topic. I'm just using
a
different example.
Yeah.
So if we just go to the example of, for instance, fifth canto, if we go to cosmology, or we go to sort of other topical issues, then first, the same type of attitude that I'm a fool, that's how actually Vaishnavas need to approach the body of Vaishnavas representatives. They don't come out saying, I think it's like this and now it's time to change something, but rather they come out in a humble, submissive mood to the leadership of the society. Vaishnavas, what do you think of this? In other words, rather than coming out thinking, I know best, I'm still maintaining that same attitude of being a fool before the representatives of Srila Prabhupada, and discussing issues like that, and then formulating one's opinion, rather than being independent, formulating an opinion, and then immediately you're just like, you know, standing behind an argument that you're going to defend tooth and nail, because it's become an issue of false ego or pride or my opinion against someone else's.
Well, the example comes into my mind of what you just said, when Brahma was seen to actually chase after his daughter, which was definitely a mistake and something that was not proper. And his sons, the Marichis, they approached him, but then in the Bhagavatam it says that they approached him in a certain way. They approached him as a superior. They approached him respectfully. They approached him in a certain mood, and then he adjusted him. He adjusted himself, and things went on. But I would like to get back to this point about the Gita, you know, in the end of the 12th chapter, there's some verses in which Krishna lays out very clearly the mentality, the behavior of a person that is pleasing to Krishna. What is it that pleases Krishna? And there's one purport in there that's very strong. I think it's the 13th and 14th verse. There's two verses in one. And the purport there, Srila Prabhupada describes that a pure devotee doesn't become disturbed or disturb others. And he thinks if somebody has become his enemy, then he's become his enemy because of something that he's done in the past that he may not be aware of. And that he never becomes the enemy of his enemy. And that he thinks that it is better, therefore, to suffer than to protest. So, of course, here there's a proper way to question. There's a proper way for clarification to put points forward. But I would think that the overall view of the Gita, if we were to calculate the number of verses or collate the number of verses, tabulate the number of verses in which Krishna asks Arjuna to be equipoised in the face of the dualities of material existence, I think you'd find that it's a quite big percentage of the verses of the Gita. So if a person isn't on that platform of realization, where at least he's got some grounding in the spiritual platform, where he's able to be equipoised and discuss things spiritually civilly, I think you might say, then it's better if that person doesn't isn't the person to challenge.
Where does one draw the line if one puts forth that his arguments are based upon defending Siddhanta? In other words, a person may appear to be aggressive, strong. I can think of many times when I personally experienced, I hear God Brother Gaur Govinda Maharaj, you know, speak out very strongly in an attempt to what he felt was defending Siddhanta against.
The difference there is that we're talking about somebody saying something critical of me.
Yes, okay.
There's a difference of that. Difference is when all I see, that I don't respond when somebody's critical of me, you know, in a negative way. But if I see someone attacking Krishna, if I see someone attacking the spiritual master, or if I see someone attacking the Siddhanta or misrepresenting the philosophy, then I should become angry. That's the proper application of anger. Yeah. But my point is, unless one has assimilated this personally and is seeing through the eyes and responding through the eyes, not out of false ego, you know, but out of actual spiritual protection.
Well, who judges that?
Guru Sadhana Shastra? There's a balance. One has to check his inner realizations in the company. So that's why I think Maharaj is saying there has to be a society in which we live in and work in, and there has to be guidelines, and there has to be checks and balances for all of us. And if there aren't, then there's, like Maharaj is saying, there's no lines, and you can't.
What was the point that you were making, Maharaj?
The point I was trying to understand Keshav Bharati Maharaj's line of reasoning is that we should always take the humble position, and in the presence of other Vaishnavas, you know, not be challenging but willing to hear, and to be subjective and to be self-analytical, self-critical about what is being said.
I should qualify or clarify what I said.
I just said, what about if somebody feels the need not to defending himself, but to defend Siddhanta?
Whatever the need or whatever the exhibition of anger or coolness or whatever, it can't be from a platform of us being overwhelmed by the modes of nature.
Obviously.
And the duality.
But that's field for the service of the Lord.
Yeah, but that anger is not the same as the anger in which one is overwhelmed by the dualities of material nature.
Completely.
That's the point I'm making.
Completely.
That if one is on that platform, and is visibly acting on that platform, then he gets that subordination from Krishna because he's pleased Krishna. When one gets to the point where one is not so disturbed that his devotional service becomes topsy-turvy and his relationships become topsy-turvy and he's steady. And I think this is the point that Maharaj was alluding to, you know, that maturity means advance in spiritual life so that one's steadiness is measured by the service and by the constant measurable even, you know, response of people and in general towards us.
Do you want to pursue that point?
Do I want to pursue the point that I was making?
Yeah, in other words, that because that's another example that of a very topical issue, origin of the jiva, fall of the jiva, where someone is very much convinced that he's, Gorgon Maharaj is very much convinced that he was actually defending Siddhanta, that the jiva does not fall from Vaikuntha. And that's the point, right?
That's the point, that issue, and then other issues. We witnessed him being very outspoken and even making statements. If you want me to stop speaking, then you'll have to cut my head off, you know, because that's the only way I'll be able to stop speaking, because I felt the necessity to defend Siddhanta and to not allow Siddhanta to be, you know, wrangled by, you know, interpretations or relativization of a collective intelligence which has lost the proper understanding of our Vaishnava Siddhanta. You know, therefore, I was just specifically using him as an example of somebody who didn't retreat and just to be mild and passive, but would speak open and speak aggressively on the basis of his internal conviction, and I felt his realization of the need to defend Siddhanta above everything else. So I only brought that point up only because I felt it was another angle of vision to look at when trying to be a little bit retrospective about, you know, the passive versus aggressiveness that a person may have, his passivity versus his being aggressive at the time, and when should one be aggressive, even in the presence of, you know, advanced devotees.
Yeah, I know, being part of those discussions, that Gorgon Maharaj is, when we're talking about attitude, his attitude remained the same. In other words, his attitude was humble, submissive, Vaishnava-like. And I think it's unfortunate that, you know, Krishna took him away from that perspective, that there should have been further forum for that type of discussion. And because he's not the only person who thought like that or continues to think like that.
I agree. I believe that his external appearance of aggressiveness was actually misperceived as aggressiveness, but it was actually true humility to Siddhanta.
Yeah,
and to Prabhupada's teachings.
The only thing I would add there was that in a society, how you actually express that as opposed to, and the best way to get the best result, rather than developing fractions, to actually try and go to the head or the heart of the leadership and discuss things in a form that keeps unity as opposed to causing another party or a fraction, which then means that it's no longer the issue that becomes the focus of an institution's attention, but actually the fact that they're sort of becoming a split. And then you lose the ability to actually deal with just philosophy, which we should be able to sit and openly discuss philosophical issues in the proper form and with the proper attitude.
It's interesting because in New York, when that controversy arose about the, you know, what was happening with the deities there, do you remember that? When Polly Madan's wife was offering chicken on the altar.
Yeah.
Remember that? It was a scandal. And there were certain devotees that, you know, stayed in their duty and didn't kind of like sauce things but didn't say anything. And there were other devotees that were whistleblowers. You know? And after the whole thing came out and it was cleaned and everything was corrected, Prabhupada wrote letters to representatives of both those sides and commended them for different reasons. And the whistleblowers commended them because if you hadn't, you know, seen it and brought it out, it wouldn't have been corrected. And the ones that actually stayed in the service and kept the service going, he said, you're commendable because you kept the services going so that there would be something left to correct.
Maharaj, you want to focus us? Are we focusing?
I'm still thinking about this maturity point because I think you got to the heart of the issue right in the beginning. Somehow or other, it may be that over the years we have confused biological maturity and experience of been there, done that, seen it all with spiritual maturity.
With real,
yes.
Krishna consciousness.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In which case, attitude, yeah, mm-hmm. and spiritual advancement, purification of the heart.
Yeah. So let's compare ourselves to the qualities that Krishna explains in the Gita, which are actually pleasing.
I think the difficulty may come due to the fact that bhakti is not a product of the material world. And it seems perhaps as we get older materially, we become materially familiar, and we unconsciously identify our biological maturity and our daily experience with, as a quid pro quo, with spiritual maturity. It seems to be very dangerous.
Developing Krishna consciousness, wisdom that comes from developing Krishna consciousness, but not perfected Krishna consciousness.
I remember once talking with one of our...
So I just make that point that we made the last time. Therefore, conditioned souls are always on shaky ground, not even challenging, but questioning liberated souls.
Yeah, that's right.
And when they, if they actually come to the liberated stage, then there's, Prabhupada would say, there's room for disagreement, even in terms of pralaya, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Jiva Goswami, they disagree on whether a partial pralaya or full pralaya takes place at the end of the Dharma. So then you have the right, because you're both speaking from the same place. But otherwise, at least that would seem to be a form of etiquette, and then of course here, but the etiquette is that even if you're liberated, what to speak of liberated, even if you're God, you still have to maintain the proper attitude that I'm just a mortal.
That's right. Good point.
I remember speaking to one of our God brothers, and he made an interesting point. One of our sannyasi God brothers, DVC members. I was presenting this concept of maturity, that, haven't we all, as individuals in a movement, haven't we, since Prabhupada's departure, speaking generally, just basically due to the passage of time and having seen this and that and what you call the wisdom of becoming older, haven't we moved ahead in maturity? His response was quite funny. He said, no, I think we've gone backwards. In other words, in spite of the biological maturity and the ordinary wisdom maturity, spiritually, you know, speaking generally, just he's provoking, you know, why not consider we've gone backwards since Prabhupada's departure? that we're not as sharp, generally speaking, as we think we are. And even if we are sharp, still out of humility and a proper attitude, we think, I'm a merc. So he was speaking about this automatic, axiomatic presentation that maturity has come to us. We are more mature because it's, after all, it's been 35 years. Isn't it about time to recognize that we have some, you know, some chutzpah, some shakti?
But that's just the opposite of what Srila Prabhupada describes there. It's just the opposite of what spiritual maturity means. And I would say that applying that to a person's tendency to challenge or to question at a certain level, I would say that the more mature he would be, the less tendency he would have to find any kind of fault. And there you go to Upashamita, and Rupa Goswami says, when will that day be mine? When I'm free from the tendency to criticize others, period. You can't imitate that. I'm not trying to say that we can imitate that, but I'm just trying to say that, going along with what Maharaj said, that spiritual maturity isn't necessarily a question of age. Look at him, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, how Prabhupada respected, you know, Puridas. You know, he put his foot, his toe in his mouth, remember? And he was just a little kid, and all of a sudden he would come out with these, you know, profound, you know, realizations and, you know, compose songs and everything, just as a baby, you know? So, again, I come back to the same point, that we should evaluate, you know, one another's credibility and one another's spiritual positions by the qualities that are there in the shastras, and that will also protect us and guide us. If a you know, person, God forbid, again, gets in a position of an absolute authority like a guru and starts to act in a way that's completely out of the, you know, the parameters given in the Bhagavad Gita, the way a person acts like that, then it'll be clear. But if persons are clouded, if they're not, you know, evaluating what they're seeing through the eyes of the shastra and through the eyes of the of Krishna's teachings, then one is tend to be misled by these things that you're talking about. The so-called maturity that comes from having become an expert, whatever, manager or an expert.
Just to qualify that statement, you said that everything, you know, if someone becomes really advanced, then they'll just accept everything or see everything, or you sort of expressed it in some way. But we are part of a what's supposed to be a dynamic preaching movement. We are meant to adapt to changing times. We're meant to come up with and face challenges for spreading Krishna consciousness and respond to what's going on in the outside world, which isn't the way it was 32 years ago when Prabhupada left the world, and which brings out sociological, philosophical questions that sometimes Prabhupada addressed them, like, for instance, with the issue of homosexuality, with some things not. And so there does need to be a certain, you know, we have to deal with things that Prabhupada didn't deal with at that time, what to speak of all the internal issues within the society that we also need to deal with, that brings a certain challenge of devotees having to address issues based on Prabhupada's teachings, which may have been general or in some cases, if we're fortunate, very specific, and then apply them. And then it does require maturity, spiritual maturity, experiential maturity, leadership maturity, those things are really sort of relevant, but in a way that the essence or the siddhanta, the mood, the direction, and of Srila Prabhupada's teachings remains intact.
Preserved.
Yeah. So that doesn't change. And that really requires what the came back, it requires realization. It requires consciousness.
The word, I think, in a word, it means core values.
Core values.
Core
yes.
values. That's what core values. The core values have to be maintained.
That's right.
So maybe over the years, the core values have drifted in our society, in generally speaking. One thing.
They have. I mean, they have. Mm-hmm. Book distribution is not the main thing in our movement, isn't it? Varnashram is a word that we talk about in terms of how it doesn't work, what to speak of Gurukula education that Srila Prabhupada envisaged, or even the type of renunciation and detachment that Prabhupada expected from grihasthas and brahmacharis, what to speak of sannyasis.
Yeah.
A lot of those core values have really sort of, they've changed. And I guess for one reason is because that same anchor, Prabhupada's physical presence, wasn't there. And sorry, you were going to...
Besides the biological maturity and the world-wise, street-wise maturity, there's also something you touched upon, Keshav Bharati Maharaj, acquisition of material expertise, competence, which makes you feel that, well, I know a lot that I didn't know before in terms of mundane knowledge, and so therefore we can devise for ourselves another perch. And we start to feel comfortable on the perch that we've devised for ourselves.
Comfort zone.
As you point out often, materially speaking, when you start getting older, it gets harder and harder to change, and you become petrified. You can become materially petrified in a certain niche, and everything all makes sense. What can we do to guard against that? Especially Prabhupada's disciples, they're getting up in their years. How do they keep themselves ever fresh and in this mood that we read about? That
preaching, going out and being out there in the vanguard and directly preaching to people, performing Harinam, being directly in contact with the Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement.
Continuing to...
I mean, aside from the basics of sadhana and so on.
Continuing to apply the teachings, to not, hold back from learning and progressing.
Doesn't include being humble and submissive before one's superiors. And if one thinks there is nobody superior, then there's a problem with that.
That's important.
It's like the example of Duryodhana versus Yudhishthira Maharaj. When Yudhishthira Maharaj was sent to look for somebody that was lower than himself, he couldn't find anybody. Duryodhana was sent to look for somebody who was superior in himself.
I'm
also part of our own protection, self-protection, is our willingness to be submissive and humble before superiors, and to seek out that association and to embrace the opportunity to have our whatever shortcomings and artists are there within our hearts, or whatever attachments or misconceptions of ourselves that have been built up over the years by material calculations, can be dispelled by submission to a superior Vaishnava. We need to go so far as that even in the association with peers, we can still feel that we're in the association of superiors. And it's not that that we have to look for the most elevated Mahabhagavata.
That's a very important point.
That even the association of peers, that real Vaishnava Sangha comes by feeling ourselves humble and inferior in the presence of somebody who is our peer, and therefore we'll keep ourselves open for Krishna to speak to the mouths of Vaishnavas to help us to understand and to be a little internal and subjective in the presence of other Vaishnavas who have realizations and have a capacity to understand something that may not be able to see due to some blind spot of that blind spot which has accumulated over my years of a blown up misconception of my actual identity. But sometimes if I may lose touch with reality, especially if I'm always in the presence of those who are worshipping me and always those who are looking at me as superior, and I may become blind and actually not be able to see something that my peers can see. And if I don't think, and if they can see it and if they don't say it, it's very well could be because they think I'm just too proud and can't hear it.
Not receptive.
And not receptive enough. So therefore, I think all the more reason why we need to display humility and submission in the association of our peers and see them as superiors.
That's interesting, because this brings out the point, maybe it brings out one fundamental problem with many devotees who were God brothers and God sisters at the time when the zonal guru system was in full swing, when it was on its, in its high days. And many people felt that the persons who took those positions no longer felt like they had peers. And I was around in situations where I could see that for myself, actually, that, the attitude came into the hearts of persons who were in those absolute positions, that, they were, a superior even to their, God brothers, or even, in the situation of peers. So what that does is it brings out the point that Maharaj is kind of sometimes bringing out, and that is that, how to bring the persons who were hurt under those circumstances to the point of being able to enter into proper sarasanga, which you're talking about, and be purified of those doubts, perhaps, and brought it back into the process of devotional service.
Respect.
I agree, but is that what we're talking about, or are we?
Well, it's related.
So many things are related. Is it a focus point?